This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoyed the programmes. Hello, Bernard Mandeville, 1670 to 1733, scandalised the British establishment with his book Fable of the Bees, in which he argued that private vices were essential to a healthy economy. Those who strive to make the world virtuous would make it poor, he said. Dishonesty supports lawyers, who then support their tailors and their cooks. Gambling diverts money from those who don't know its value to those who do and can invest it wisely. Many of our virtues, he wrote, are in fact disguised vices. Mandeville was one of the first to emphasise the role of the consumer in the economy rather than the state, and he was to influence ideas from Adam Smith in the 18th century to Keynes and Hayek in the 20th. With me to discuss the fable of the bees are David Wooden, Professor of History at the University of York, Helen Paul, Lecturer in Economics and Economic History at the University of Southampton, and John Callanan, Senior Lecturer in Philosophy at King's College London. David Wooden, what do we need to know about Bernard Mandeville's early life in Rotterdam?
His father is a doctor. He's raised in a city which is one of the commercial capitals of the world at the time, and Holland is one of the intellectual capitals of the world at the time. Mandeville goes to the Erasmus School, and he's obviously given lots of Erasmus to read as a young man, refers to Erasmus a lot in his later writings. But what's really important is that a great intellectual, Pierre Bayle, is teaching just down the road in the illustrious academy. And Bayle is...
Why do you call him great?
Because he's the inventor of the sort of paradox that Mandeville likes to rely on later. Bayle's great paradox, which he announces in 1680, is that atheists are capable of forming a good society, as good a society, a better society than Christians. It's a shocking idea. Mandeville, as a young man, clearly imbibes these sort of strange ideas. And when he goes on to university, he carries with him the inheritance of Bayle.
And he quotes, he plagiarises Bayle.
He plagiarises him, he quotes him. He clearly is deeply influenced by him.
Then, age 20, he left Rotterdam. Why was that?
He goes to Leiden, and he studies philosophy.
Then he goes to London.
He goes to London later.
Leiden and London, they lied.
He studies both philosophy and medicine, and he spends 5 years training as a doctor and training as a philosopher. And as a philosopher, he publishes on the intelligence of animals, and he takes a Cartesian view, which is that animals have no intelligence. Animals are simply robots. But later on, he turns against that and insists that animals are rather like humans, or humans are rather like animals, that they're, you can't draw a line between the animal world and the human world.
So there's philosophy, there's anthropology, there's religion and anti-religion all mixing in.
Yes.
And, of course, commerce, because he's brought him into what could be called the commercial capital of the world at that time.
Yes.
And he takes all that on board, doesn't he?
He takes all that on board, and his father loses his position in Rotterdam and is driven into exile. There's a tax riot about engaged in drinking unlicensed wine, and his father gets kicked out of the city, and so he's got no home to go back to. And he clearly goes on his travels. It looks as if he goes to Rome. He ends up in London. He likes it there, and he decides to stay. And he turns into a Londoner.
How does he turn into a Londoner?
Well, he turns into a Londoner and he starts practicing medicine in London without a license, which is lots of people are doing, but it's something that's frowned upon. And he marries an English woman and settles down. And he becomes extraordinarily brilliant at writing in English. He's like, reminds me of someone like Conrad, for English is his second, third, fourth language, but he writes it extraordinarily well.
What medicine does he practice?
He's interested in hypochondria and in hysteria. And so he publishes. He's essentially a psychologist. He's trying to persuade people to settle down and overcome their anxieties. And so his treatment is very much one of trying to stabilize people.
Is he successful?
It's hard to tell. We don't know much about his
life. He ends up prosperous. Is it because of his work as a psychologist?
He's in his will, leaves £500. That's not a lot. It's something.
One of you said prosperous.
That's probably me.
And so he's settled in London. He's making his way in London. We know very little about him, in fact. That's what we're scraping the barrel for. But he wants to be a writer and be part of the literary swim there was around at the time. He wanted to be part of it.
Yes, though he doesn't seem to know many writers. He seems to hang out with... It's hard to tell who he hangs out with. The only person who ever meets him is Benjamin Franklin. He says Mandeville has a little club of his own, and he's a very entertaining man, but nobody else meets him. It's very odd.
Helen Paul, what was distinctive about the Dutch economy? And let's stick with that for a moment.
Well, the Dutch had not very much in terms of what's on the land, although famously windmills and things like that, but they were a flat country that could be easily invaded. And one of the things that spurred them on to try to defend themselves was to create the economic growth that allowed them to take on bigger rivals. They were Protestants, their bigger rivals were Catholic, and there was always this issue about potential invasion. Now, because they had a maritime economy, and because Europeans had shipbuilding technology that could deal with ocean travel, what they did was they did very long journeys to buy luxury goods, most famously through the Dutch East India Company, and then through the Dutch East India Company's various financing. That's what starts the first shares and the first share trading. It starts their financial revolution, the development of their stock market. So for a small country with not a lot of natural resources, they become a bit like, say, a Singapore today. They become really dependent on this trade and finance.
How did that influence, or how do you think it influenced Mandeville's ideas?
I think probably it would have been obvious to him that you have to have this luxury trade, because if you're bringing in goods there from so far away, they have to be luxuries to make it worthwhile financially to do so, and you need a customer. And so if you're going to go on about luxury being terrible, you lose your customer base. You can't ban this desire for luxury and also have the Dutch East India Company. And without the Dutch East India Company, you don't have Dutch independence in the way that you would want. So it's a kind of a conundrum that can't be solved by moralising. It's a bit of an oddity. So with Mandeville...
Why does he see it as a conundrum?
Well, it's a conundrum because everybody else is saying that it would be better for a state to have virtuous citizens behaving in a virtuous way, and that love of luxury destroys states, like ancient Rome. So the classically educated are told this, and then clergymen repeat that message to their congregations.
Reinforced by Christianity.
Exactly, and it becomes a kind of standard belief that Mandeville, because he's such willing to go against these standard beliefs, is able to say, look, this is not true.
Is there any sense that this luxury goods are thought to be tainted by harvesting labour and so on overseas?
And that's probably not a great concern for them. They're more interested in the mercantilist argument that what you should be doing is exporting a lot of goods and trying not to import, and that the consumption of luxuries weakens people at home. I'm not sure that they're that particularly interested in who it is who's actually producing the spices or the silk somewhere far away at this time period.
At this time, when he's beginning to form his ideas, was he alone or were people around him? David's talking about Bale. Was there anyone else?
It's very hard to know who he actually spoke to face to face. He's certainly learning from a French tradition of scepticism about how you can have outward opinions that are about virtue or about religiosity, but that your own personal opinions might be very different. You're hiding your self-interestedness behind this facade. And he's got that from people like Bayle.
Thomas Hobbes.
And also Hobbes, and I think Machiavelli as well. There's that sense of telling the truth, showing a very pragmatic view of human nature that's quite a cynical view.
But human nature is passionate and unreasoned and uncontrollable.
And self-interested and egotistical and all these other horrible things.
Which we will follow.
Yes.
John Cullen, what did Mandeville write when he first came to London?
It takes him about 10 years to get writing. When he arrives in London, he says he came there to learn the language. But really, as David was pointing out, he had no more future in Rotterdam because he was identified as being deeply involved with some of the riots that were caused such a scandal there. And so he was forced to go somewhere, and he had to go somewhere where that was tolerant of Protestants, and where there was a thriving literary scene, because that's his other great love, as well as medicine. And London is really one of the few places where he could go. And religious toleration is a theme of his writing throughout. Pierre Bayle arrived in Rotterdam because Louis XIV revoked the Edict of Nantes, and there was a refugee crisis, basically, of Protestants into the Dutch Republic. So when he arrives in London, he starts trying to build a practice, but as soon as he can master the language, he starts writing, and he starts writing things with a political slant, usually. The first thing he writes is The Pamphleteers, which is praising the recently deceased William III, pointing out that it was William III who stopped popery taking over the whole of Europe, and it's William III who stopped every school being a place of religious indoctrination. And but that's quite earnest in his style. Pretty quickly afterwards, he starts adopting a more playful, a more coarse, and a more bawdy style. He starts off, as is very popular at the time, adapting Aesop's fables, either translating them or adding fables of your own, and adding a moral at the end that has some kind of political slant. For example, in 1698, there's Aesop at Islington, which has the story of the yeoman and the snake. The yeoman takes in, the honest and kind yeoman takes in a half-starved snake. It recovers and it bites him. And the moral is, beware of all these Dutch immigrants that are coming in. They'll leave you with just their clogs. You're doing too much luxury trade, and all we're getting are their immigrants. And so when he starts adapting his own versions of Jean Fontaine's versions of Aesop's fables, he also adds political slants of his own. He tells one about the frogs who wish for a king. They're running themselves, but they get a bit bored. He thinks the English are always discontent with their contemporary political situation. They get a bit bored and they pray to Jove for a king. He sends down a crane who starts to eat them. And the moral is, be careful what you ask for. And also, isn't it great that the English are content not to always change their government? That's the little rhyme he puts at the end. And there's a lot of these themes pop up again in his later writings as well. But if he can, he'll express himself in a more coarse or bawdy way.
Why do you think that is?
There's a kind of a vein of Dutch carnality through all his writing.
Why is carnality Dutch? Why have they a monopoly on being carnal?
They don't have a monopoly, but they're just very good at it. And he's also, his training is, he's examined the human being literally underneath the skin. He thinks of the human being, he specialises in digestion. He sees how digestion relates to mood. A lot of the study of the medical anxiety and depression and panic attacks, he diagnoses those as problems to do with lifestyle. Do you have a regular diet? Do you have moderate exercise? He doesn't have any highfalutin theories about runs the human being. He thinks it's we're a lot more base and a lot more animal-like. And so he's always looking for more base explanations for our behaviour.
David Wootton, in 1705, he wrote a poem, The Grumbling Hive. That was important for him and became important in a later book and important for us, therefore. What was that about?
Well, The Grumbling Hive is a reworking of the fable of be careful what you wish for. It's about a prosperous hive of bees who are very rich and successful and constantly complaining that the world is going to the dogs, that everyone's corrupt, that people are obsessed with money, that it would be so much nicer if people were honest and careful and frugal and are law-abiding. And one day Jove gets fed up with hearing all these complaints, and so he says, right, from now on you'll be good. And as soon as they start being good, everything starts collapsing. The people who make locks run out of business because nobody needs locks anymore. The lawyers are no longer hard because there's no crime anymore. The taverns close because no one's getting drunk anymore. The tailors are no longer being hard because people are happy to wear old clothes. The economy just folds. And the moral of the story is be careful what you wish for. It's actually greed and a pride and the desire to be better than your fellows. All these evil qualities that make us a successful society. And the success is inseparable from these evil qualities.
Did it have any impact, that poem? Like, it's a bit of doggerel, really.
It's 400 lines of doggerel.
A poem is stretching it a bit, but never mind. Did it have much impact?
It's reprinted it's pirated, so it sells successfully. It comes out in quite expensive copy of 30 pages for sixpence, which is quite a lot of money. And it's pirated in 4 pages very rapidly. So it sells, but nobody mentions it. It essentially disappears.
And we don't find it influencing other people around. So it doesn't enter into conversation any daily literature of the time. He plants his camp there, doesn't he?
Yes. I mean, he goes on to produce a thing called The Female Tatler, which is directed against people like Addison and Steele, who are producing magazines, the next after they've produced first of all The Tatler and then The Spectator, which are designed to encourage a sort of moral and polite society. And Mandeville produces The Female Tatler, which is designed to take mock at this. And one of the things it does is say, well, there's a whole section of it given over to showing that women can be as good as men, that you can overturn existing conventions and assumptions about how society ought to be ordered.
And that too is ignored, I presume.
That's quite successful for a little while, I think, but it doesn't make any big impact.
Helen Paul, there wasn't a great deal of buzz around, as David said about that. What was changing in the British economy that made his work more pressing as time went on, as we come to the bigger book, The Fable of the Bees?
Right, yes, we get the start of the Hanoverian regime, so we've got, as well, we move into the South Sea bubble period, where there's a massive financial crash, not just in London, but also in Paris. And then there are echoes of it in Amsterdam and Hamburg without them having bubbles per se. And this is the first international financial crisis of its type, which perhaps has been overstated in terms of its real effects, but is hugely scary to people at the time. As well, you also have the prospect of Jacobite uprisings, not the more famous one of the 45, but the 1715 and the 1719 uprisings. So there's a sense of
the Catholics coming back.
Yes, the Catholics coming back. And also you've got, when you've got the end of a big war, you've got an influx of all the old soldiers, etc., who've come back into the country. And are they unemployed? You've got a surplus labour. Are they going to become Jacobite? Are they going to rise up? So there's a lot of concern and anxiety, some of which the worries are overstated with hindsight, but at the time are truly frightening to people.
And that restlessness was something that appealed to Mandeville. I mean, appealed to his taste in ideas.
Well, it seems like his ideas became in tune with this restlessness, because of course his grumbling hive predated all of this, but then his larger work, The Fable of the Bees, starts to be taken up as being very shocking or important or a success to Scandal after all of these events. So perhaps he benefits from other people's misfortune and worries in some way.
John Callanan, David Wooten has said that He thinks that Mandeville was the first person to come up with the idea that public benefit comes from private vice. Had he any precursors in that?
He had a few precursors. That's the paradox that he tries to introduce in the 1714, when he converts the poem, The Grumbling Hive, into a larger work with lots of remarks attached to it, like lettered footnotes.
Fable of the Bees.
The Fable of the Bees. And he as Helen was pointing out, he reissues this work at points of political tension. In 1705, people are worried about which way Queen Anne is going to go. They're worried about Marlborough and the war, Spanish succession, and whether this is making the country stronger or weaker. In 1714, when he does The Fable of the Bees, they're worried about Queen Anne has passed, and they're worried about what the new, what George will be like when he comes in. And in 1723, when it really becomes a scandal, they're worried about the South Sea bubble and has the morals of the market gone to hell. But in terms of this idea of private vices turning into public benefits, there's a quite rich history in theology, really, where, that Mandeville's education draws upon when he's trying to present this to the English. So, for example, Erasmus's Praise of Folly is simply praising something that is straightforwardly bad. And in some sense, it's a satire, but he's making some real points. Folly, ignorance, deception, these things grease the wheels of society. We couldn't really get on, Erasmus says, if we didn't deceive ourselves towards the faults of others and our own faults. We'd never, he says, if we didn't have folly, there'd be no husbands and wives, there'd be no friends, there'd be no servants and masters. We wouldn't tolerate each other for a moment. And I think Erasmus is making a point that he thinks is true. There are frailties of human nature that sometimes lead to positive benefits overall. And this gets taken up again in the sceptical tradition that Helen was mentioning of French Augustinianism. So Augustine thinks that we're fundamentally corrupted and that we're driven by our vices since the fall from Eden, and there's without divine grace we can't perform moral action at all. But some of the people who take this up in the French tradition, like Jacques Abadie, say, of course, sometimes some of our vices, like our drive for esteem, our drive for success, we create fantastic poetry, we create the stage, we create great art. God has given us rationality to form wise governments, but he's also given us drives for success so that we can improve other aspects of society as well. And he thinks it's all providential.
David Wharton, what did he see as his clear targets at Mandeville?
One target by 1723 is Shaftesbury. Shaftesbury's published a work called The Characteristics, in which he essentially argues that human beings are good, they're benevolent, they're sociable. We naturally want to get on with each other, and the whole universe has been constructed providentially, the system of nature and the system of human society. Shaftesbury loves the word system, he keeps using it. We're all part of a system that's designed to work, and one aspect of this is our natural love for our fellow human beings. And Mandeville finds this an intolerable misrepresentation of how human beings actually are. Human beings are naturally cantankerous and difficult and competitive and angry. And the question Mandeville wants to ask is, given, he says, the way to find out what human beings are really like is to look at small children. Mm-hmm. Small children are really difficult and willful. How is it that you can socialize them? And what Mandeville's argument fundamentally is that we are a unique species in that we socialize ourselves, we domesticate ourselves, we train ourselves, and we do that by praising each other. You praise a little child when they learn how to do a curtsy in his world, or in our world, how to do up their own shoelaces. And the older child thinks, well, everybody knows how to do up their own shoelaces. And you take the older child and say, yes, but if we tell little Tommy that he's clever, he'll learn how to do it and he'll do it again. And by flattery, we train people to be sociable, and this works because they internalize other people's view of them, and they think, oh, I'm clever, and so they want to do it in the future. And Mandeville's, I think, brilliant in taking the notion that you internalize other people's view of you, and this becomes what matters crucially to you, so that you're socialized by your society.
So virtue is a construct like language. It's something that we have constructed, and it isn't innate.
It's entirely artificial. Just like language, just like money, and different societies have fundamentally different virtues as they have fundamentally different languages, and virtue changes over time. The morals that we inculcate, the values that matter, polygamy and monogamy and so on, all of these things change radically over time, and so a new commercial society needs new virtues, if we want to call them virtues, but most virtues are in fact the public presentation of something that's supposed to be estimable, but underlying it is pride, self-esteem, competitiveness.
Helen Paul, The Fable of the Bees, that was published in 1714, no great impact there, but came back in 1723 and to great impact. Why was that, and can you tell us a bit about it?
Well, this is post-South Sea bubble, for a start. There's been a bit of tinkering with the various editions, but perhaps it's just the timing of it, that it's just this post-bubble period when there's been a religious revival that's been brewing for a while. There's also this great demand for the public to reform itself, and for also for the people at the top, like Walpole, to be virtuous.
Can we just burst the South Sea bubble? Some people might not know about it. This great investment scam. The riches to be made, everybody piled in, including Newton, lost a lot of money.
Unfortunately, that's the story. The reality is it's not quite so extreme, but certainly that's the way people thought about it. You certainly had this sense that there was a, quote, gambling mania, even though there really wasn't. There was this fear of a nouveau riche appearing, of a new financial class appearing, the old order being upended. And basically, you get people being too enthusiastic about shares. The price goes up, it drops. And there's this post-crash outpouring of hysteria. Walpole, who's really our first prime minister, steps in to hide some of the people at the top who are involved in this, like the mistress of the king and these sorts of folk. And he's known to be doing this. But there's all this anti-Walpole rhetoric about, you know, you need to be virtuous, society needs to be virtuous, politicians need to be virtuous. And so when Mandeville publishes the umpteenth edition, the 1723 edition of The Fable of the Bees, the timing is right because people are already all worked up already, and here's something for them to be further upset about.
And it becomes notorious. The book is tried in the Middlesex courts and burned in France.
It is indeed, yes. Yes.
The other thing that's
which he loves, of course.
Well, I imagine it's just increased his sales, probably.
The other thing, there's just been the last great bubonic plague in Europe. 40,000 people die in Marseille, 1720. And people in England have sat waiting for the plague to come and kill them. By 1723, they've begun to celebrate the fact that they're not going to be killed by the plague. And the Middlesex grand jury say, if we have people like Mandeville around publishing this sort of thing, God will strike us. Plague will come. There's a real sense that society has become so corrupt that there's a danger of divine intervention. And this is a world in which there's a new society for the promotion of Christian knowledge. There's a vast number of moral improvement organizations being founded to try and get rid of prostitution, which is everywhere. Gin palaces, hard liquor is new and it's taking over. The sense that the world is going to the dogs is very powerful, both from the right, from Jacobites, Catholics, and high church people, and from the left, from dissenters, from Presbyterians.
John Cullen.
Just one of the peculiarities of it. In 1705, he writes that greed is good and there's no impact. In 1714, he writes that morality is a construct and there's no shock. But it's in 1723 when there is a shock, and that's when he adds an essay on charity schools, which is one of these projects for the Society of the Reformation of Manners, trying to make people better people, trying to get your neighbours to inform on each other when you think they're fornicating too much or drinking too much or not going to church regularly. Even Jonathan Swift is writing against some of the excesses of these things. But also Mandeville sees these societies and the schools as hotbeds of Catholic education and popery. And so he writes against them because he's against anything that the Tories are in favour of.
So let's talk about him being against charity schools, which raises a lot of hackles.
That's exactly why the book is presented to the court.
Yeah.
Because and also some other writings by two writers.
But can you tell the listeners what he says that raises people's hackles?
Well, he says that it's important to have a large body of labouring poor. That is what we have to keep some people at in the poor class in order for the whole system to work. And the charity school was about moving people out of poverty. And so Mandeville looks like he's an apologist for a class system. And his motives are really much more political and bombastic and literary, but he always goes over the top. He always says, instead of saying perhaps these charity schools are sources of political instruction, he says, let's not make poor people, let's keep poor people poor. What's so great about charity anyway? So he always goes over the top in order to make his point.
And to take on what's so great about charity anyway, David, he actually says it's not really charity. It's, you tell me.
Well, he does say the motives that these people... Mandeville is talking about what we now call virtue signalling. He's saying people are constantly saying, I want to be charitable. What they're really doing is pushing themselves forward to the front of their communities and saying, I'm a community leader. And in that sense, the charity schools are just a form of virtue signalling. People aren't really interested in the children of the poor and giving them an education.
Says.
That's what he's saying. But what he's also saying, and I think it's a really important point he's trying to make, he's saying just having good intentions doesn't mean that what you do is going to have a good outcome. You can go around saying, I'm trying to help you, but actually, I mean, this is sort of modern argument you get against the welfare state. If you put everyone on welfare, you're saying, I'm helping you, but you may actually be making it harder for them to go on and look for work. The enterprise, the intention doesn't tell you what the outcome's going to be. In order to understand what the outcome's going to be, you have to look at the causal mechanisms at work. The outcome of this is going to be a lot of people who are overeducated, who expect to get well-paid positions, are unable to find them, and will be unhappy and resentful through the rest of their lives. Well, if they'd never been given these false expectations, they could have been perfectly contented, yes.
Yeah. He's talking about then.
Yes, absolutely, he's talking about then.
Yes, and as well, this is long before the Industrial Revolution. So the idea that you're training people up to do a job that doesn't yet exist, the idea of, well, we'll train you up and you'll have all these skills. If you're talking about a pre-industrial economy, you're really dealing with labour-intensive activities. So someone's got to empty the chamber pots and somebody's got to empty the privies. This is not nice work. If you educate people, according to Mandeville, you make them do these jobs, but you've raised their consciousness, as it were. You've raised their standards, and now they're further disappointed. So psychologically, it's not very good for them either.
And he says, you know, it's no good saying there are lots of poor people who are perfectly intelligent. We must give them opportunities, because you'll be turning around next and saying there are lots of intelligent, clever women. We must give them opportunities. Once you've started on that path, there's no end to where you'll end up. And, of course, he's right. I mean, that's absolutely correct.
Does he have a connection with Machiavelli?
Well, I suppose in the sense that he's very pragmatic and he's looking at the dark side of human nature that might somehow be realistic, that if you want a good outcome, sometimes you have to accept the way people actually are, not how you'd like them to be. And of course, Machiavelli as well upset people, as Mandeville did. So you do get this success to scandal as well.
What do you think?
And Machiavelli had said, I'm not talking about how a human being ought to be. I'm just telling you what a successful prince, in fact, does when they're successful. And Mandeville echoes this language deliberately. He says, I'm not going to tell you how to be a wonderful human being. I'm going to tell you what human beings are actually like. I'm going to anatomise their behaviour, much like he does in his medical training.
He shares with Machiavelli a delight in being naughty. I mean, he's taking great pleasure in provoking people to anger. Machiavelli clearly, in his plays, likes shocking people. There's a real desire to expose the hypocrisy of the rest of society by saying, I can go beyond the limits that other people recognise.
Before you come in, can we steer this back to the things that Mandeville was saying that really offended people? We've slightly gone to one side of it. He said things that vice is good, that these things... He kept prostitution was necessary and essential for chastity. He went out again and again, and this offended a great number of people. Can we concentrate a bit on the things that he said that upset the people who wanted to live and thought they lived in a virtuous society and thought that virtue was worth pursuing?
He maintains his satirical pose is that he also thinks virtue is wonderful. He says, when people say he's promoting vices, he goes, oh no, I would prefer a small, poor, impoverished, weak, internationally disregarded nation, but we'd have honesty. Wouldn't that be lovely? So, of course, people see through the satirical pose, because in the same work, he's saying he looks at the djinn craze, he looks at its effects on society and says, overall, though, the industry that it promotes makes it worthwhile. He says he looks at the problem of public prostitution and he says, what we really need to do here is legalise it. He And again, he looks at the charity schools and he says, what we really need are more poor people, less educated. So he maintains at the one point, on one hand, that he is, and he says, this is the work of strictest morality, he says at one point. If we were being moral, this is what would happen. Unfortunately, we're not. And by the way, since we're not, we may as well take some financial advantage out of our weakness.
Are these and other emphatic ideas arousing people's wrath?
Yes, they certainly are. I mean, everybody starts publishing against him. He becomes the bogeyman for intellectuals in the 1730s and 1740s. So Hutcheson is said moral philosopher in Scotland. Hutcheson is said can't give a lecture without pausing to attack Mandeville, and so the sense that Mandeville is someone who's actually seen into something real about society, but at the same time we can't allow it to be possible to draw those conclusions. The sense that you've got to both acknowledge something in Mandeville but also reject it becomes fundamental.
Further economists seem to have had to square the circle of finding a way to believe in virtue while finding a way to agree with Mandeville. Is that right? Can you discuss that in terms of Adam Smith?
Yes, Mandeville was a huge influence on David Hume and Adam Smith. Adam Smith was taught by Francis Hutcheson, and so by this time, we're talking now the second half of the 18th century, Mandeville is probably the most notorious name in European Republic of Letters. So you do not want to be associated with his view. And in A Theory of Moral Sentiments, Adam Smith attacks Mandeville's view. He attacks it in a section called Of Licentious Systems. One of the tricky things that Adam Smith has to deal with is that he agrees a lot with many of the things that Mandeville says. He thinks that, well, social approval is an important part of how human beings interact. And he thinks, yes, we do get a bit of pleasure out of doing good and being seen to do good. But he doesn't want to, so he wants to accept some of Mandeville's premises but not take on Mandeville's conclusion that that virtue is a mere social construct. So he says, well, it's possible, and he's taking a bit of this from Francis Hutcheson, it's possible that we just have a basic sense of doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do, a moral sense, and it's possible that when we do that, we feel good, and so there's some self-interest in there as well. But we don't do it for the sake of self-interest, we do it just because it's just another natural instinct that we have.
Mandeville says if we see a child falling into the fire, and we know the child is going to burn to death, we spring forward to rescue the child. Why do we do this? We do this because it's going to upset us, because we don't like the smell of burning flesh. We do it to relieve our own suffering. Now, Smith and Hume come along and say, well, actually, it's a bit of two things here. We are avoiding our own suffering. It would be painful for us to experience. We are also concerned about the child, and they try and get the best of both worlds out of this and say, well, yes, we're motivated by selfish motives, but we are also benevolent, and so they try and accept Mandeville's account of human nature, but at the same time say we're a bit nicer than he says we are.
And his ideas, John's talked about, is the influence in this country in the 18th century. They spread to Europe, didn't they? Especially with the two great Europeans, Voltaire and Rousseau.
Yes, I mean, Smith says that the whole of Rousseau's discourse on inequality is taken straight out of Mandeville. And that, in a sense, is correct. Mandeville, in his later, largest reworking of The Fable of the Beast, tries to give an account of how we developed out of savage society into modern, commercial, unequal society. Rousseau follows that line of argument. The difference between Mandeville and Rousseau is Rousseau says, if this is where we are, hypocrites, greedy, selfish, this is intolerable. We must find a way of getting out of this. Mandeville says this is the best it can be when it's never going to be better than this. But they agree entirely about the description of what their modern world, their contemporary world, is like. They disagree about whether they approve of it or disapprove of it.
And what's Voltaire's take?
Oh, Voltaire's in England during the great hoo-ha over The Fable of the Bees, and he adores the book. And when he's back in France and living with Madame du Châtelet, who's a mathematician and a physicist, he teaches her English by getting her to translate Mandeville's Fable of the Bees. This is, for him, the most interesting production of contemporary English civilization.
And it trucks through Helen Paul. In what ways did Hayek and Keynes develop Mandeville's ideas?
Well, Hayek was very impressed with Mandeville. Hayek is a proponent of a minimal government intervention, that the individual self-interestedness is a normal feature of life, and we should not shy away from that. And you can see that that comes back to, through Smith, back to Mandeville with this idea of allowing people to pursue their own interests. The idea that you are, by allowing them to do that, you end up with a system that's not designed in a top-down way by any kind of government or tyrant. So that appeals to Hayek, who's very much on the right. With Keynes is looking at how the what we call the fallacy of composition. If you are thinking in terms of a household being thrifty, if you think that's good, that doesn't necessarily mean it scales up to the economy as a whole. If everyone is thrifty, if no one buys luxury goods, the economy shrinks. And you can see how post-1929, post-Depression, that would be important. You need people to spend money in order to have jobs and services and in order to keep the economy going. So that, again, you can go to the left or the right and you can still use Mandeville's interests in self-interestedness and luxury.
Talking about Keynes, does he mention and tick off as an influence Mandeville? I have a feeling Mandeville went out of fashion. He wasn't somebody you like to say I was influenced by.
Well, Hayek talks about Mandeville, and Keynes liked what Hayek had written. He didn't necessarily agree with it. But what Keynes did like is this notion of consumption being important. He did say that that's what Mandeville had pointed out at a time when it wasn't really understood that the consumer spending or consumer confidence was important to the economy, because people felt that that was somehow drawing bullion or gold and silver or whatever away from the state and its needs.
And thrift was the answer.
And thrift was the answer, that if you were thrifty, you didn't let your wife buy imported goods and wear all these fancy dresses, that you would be better off. You'd be just sending out exports.
What, John Connellan, what do you think is today's legacy of the Fable of the Bees?
I think the legacy today comes, he's been very unpopular as a moral philosopher for a long time, and his popularity is returning now more as a social anthropologist and an observer of convention and as a proto-economic theorist. One of the things he's left us with by influencing Adam Smith is the notion of the invisible hand, the idea that if you leave people to follow their own vices and self-interested desire and pride, things somehow, for some reason, tend to work out quite well. A system spontaneously starts to just manage itself and regulate itself internally. He took this from the theologians who said, well, that was the hand of God, obviously. But Mandeville says, no, it just happens. And he says, why does it happen? Well, chickens come from eggs, I don't know. He just says it's something that just emerges. And Smith takes that on, and then that becomes, of course, a hugely important idea in contemporary economics.
And finally, what do you think of the idea itself that's been expanded by the...
I think Mandeville grasps for the first time how society can work without divine order. In that sense, he's the first social scientist, he's the first person to produce a truly secular understanding of what holds society together and makes it possible. And he does this through this brilliant literary technique of constantly saying, oh, I'm a good Christian and I'm really on the side of virtue. He never persuades anyone of that. Everyone always understands that really he's trying to step outside religion, step away from religion, mock and destroy religion. And in that sense, I think he points entirely to what for most Europeans is the future, the enlightened secular future of understanding society in secular terms.
Well, thank you very much, David Wood, Helen Paul and John Callanan. Next week, it's Free Radicals, the highly reactive atoms or molecules essential to life but which our bodies have to keep in check. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
Mandeville introduces the concept of the division of labour.
Yes, you didn't say that.
And he also, I think...
I thought Adam Smith's division.
Everyone says it's in. I was rereading all the passages of Mandeville. There's supposed to be division of labour. It's not quite Smith.
No, it's not. It's not. Smith takes some of the ideas and develops them in a different way. I think Mandeville. I think for me, one of the biggest influences that he's had is having a theory of our motivations that aren't at all clear to ourselves. The idea that the human being is driven by passions that we then subsequently rationalise with some story about ourselves in order to make it all make sense, and that somehow this all works out. But it's a theory of rationality that I think is completely new. We're not a rational human being in the sense that we use, we think, reflect self-consciously, access all the right truths and use those truths to plan our action. He says we get pushed by some passions and then we try and make up some story to explain why we did what we did. And that's what rationality is. It's a kind of an excuse mechanism. This is a theory that's quite popular right now in contemporary cognitive science. They think, what is consciousness? It's something that we do to help explain all the actions that our bodies are pushing us towards.
He's the 18th century Freud. His theory about how we socialize ourselves works very much like Freud's theory of the superego. We internalize other people's view of us, us, and what we want is to get on good terms with this external view of us, which becomes our own view of ourselves. I mean, that's entirely Freud's account of the superego. He's a sort of proto-Freudian.
When was he recognised as a proto-Freudian?
Here by today, by me.
Marx.
The wooden recognition, the wooden mark of recognition. Yeah. Well, that'll do.
Marx read Mandeville and appreciated him. Darwin read Mandeville and appreciated him. And they both appreciate this thing about how some kind of rational order can emerge even when the agents aren't trying to be rational, even when they're the good of the hive can come about, even though none of the bees have this intention of creating a grand hive. They're just trying to do whatever their instincts drive them to do. And somehow a nice, buzzing, well-ordered hive emerges. And that's and that has a kind of a rational order that comes out of nature itself.
Oh, hang on. When I was telling the lads about this, I was on Radio 3 talking about the fable of the bees, and they brought on a bee expert. And so he had various experts who said, and the bees do this in the hive, and Mandeville says that. And every so often, they'd turn to this lady and they'd say, and is that what bees do? And she'd say, no. This just went on and on. So nature in reality versus Mandeville's understanding.
I didn't interrupt when you were talking inside the programme, but I did some. But when you were saying that we as a species schooled our children to virtue by saying, young Tommy, don't do that, and if you don't do that, I'll give you a Mars bar, that sort of thing. Animals do that.
Yes,
you see foxes training their cubs. I mean, they do that.
That's
exactly
right.
The same. What's different about us?
Well, that's why Mandeville starts off being educated by Cartesians. Cartesians insist we're rational animals and are robots. He turns against that whole position and says there is no crucial difference between humans and animals. The only difference, I think, for him would be that when a fox teaches its cubs how to do something, this is a form of training. But what doesn't happen with the cub is the cub doesn't imagine what its mother is thinking about it. Well, what matters for human beings is that we create this, we end up, Mandeville says, worshipping ourselves. We create this imaginary self, which is what matters to us.
But might not the cub think, if I do that, I'll get more milk from my mother?
Yes.
The reward we get is the approval of the mother.
Well, milk a source of approval?
Well, it's also a source of milk. It's we're more keen on approval. We're more keen on approval. That's the thing that really does mark us out, Mandeville thinks.
Yeah.
We are slightly different from animals. We're the only ones who really have pride, having such a strange, the desire for self-esteem, having such a role in our cognitive lives.
This Rousseau's notion, the horrible notion that we live in other people's view of us, that we have no sense of authenticity because we become obsessed with how do we look to other people. This is what this is the sort of creature Mandeville thinks we are bound to be, people who are constantly asking how does this look to someone else.
So when people go backstage and say to actor, when the actors say to them, how was I? They're just being superhumans.
Yes.
In fact,
yes.
They want reassurance because they don't know.
They constantly want reassurance.
I've also
heard.
Mandeville's point is that we're taught to be a good young man or be a good girl or don't be a baby or try to be a good member of the species and win the approval of our parents way before we have any sense of morality, any sense of what makes something philosophically or theologically or whatever the right thing to do. We're so indoctrinated into the economy of esteem, into seeking approval. Mandeville says by the age of 3, a young girl knows not to show her leg in male company. She's no idea about sexual morality or anything of what's going on. She knows there's a proper way to be, but she has no idea what it's all about. And in a sense, he's saying that's what we're like. We have all these notions of the proper way to be, but we don't really understand what we're doing. We're just signalling to be virtuous. We're not really being virtuous.
But the proper way to be changes from age to age, doesn't it?
He thinks that there is he is a bit of a relativist. He thinks that in various different societies they'll have different particular rules, but they'll all be different rules that the parents in that society approve of. There'll be different stories about what it is to be a fine young man in Syria in 1800, what it is to be in Greece. He's a complete relativist about these things. What he wants to say is there are some fundamental creatures of the human animal, which is the desire for esteem. That, he thinks, is universal.
But what he thinks has happened is that we've got, he in his world, you might say this is true of us in our world, have got trapped with a moral code and moral language which is out of date, which no longer applies to a commercial society. So we're obsessed with honour, we're obsessed with chastity, we're obsessed with virtue. All of these things are irrelevant to a well-functioning commercial society, but they are being inculcated in the charity schools, from the pulpits and so on, and they've become actually socially dysfunctional. And in that sense...
Do you agree with him?
Do I agree with him? I think... We live in a world now where we have divorce, where we have sexual freedoms that are extraordinarily extensive, and Mandeville's calling for that world. So yes, I think he sees the direction that we have moved to, and I think in general you lose certain things as you move into a more permissive society. You gain certain things.
He also thinks that things like narratives of austerity is moral political rhetoric and not an economic policy in itself. There's the talk of living within your means, tightening your belts, that everyone has to just pull up their socks and be virtuous, and then we will be a great society. He says that's just not an economic policy.
We are about to be offered the BBC's Choice of the Hour with our producer, Simon Tillotson.
Yeah, offer you the imported luxuries of tea or coffee.
yes.
Tea, coffee?
Coffee, please.
I'll have some tea, please.
In Our Time with Melvyn Bragg is produced by Simon Tillotson.
Everyone seems to be falling over themselves to employ war heroes.
Doesn't mean that they can just walk into any job.
September 1918.
Just thinking, it must be hard for you with your father away fighting.
No harder than it is for anyone else.
The war continues to cast a shadow.
Did he die recently? Your son's friend?
He did, yes. The day before yesterday.
While on the home front, society begins to adapt to a new age.
Isabel's always been headstrong, and now she has the votes. There will be no stopping her.
Homefront. You can subscribe to the podcast or download the episodes from the Homefront pages at the BBC Radio 4 website.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Full of merriment, mischief, and mistaken identity, enjoy this audiobook collection of 8 of Shakespeare's most magical comedies, starring David Tennant, Helena Bonham Carter, and Miriam Margolyes.
Nobody marks you.
What, my dear Lady Disdain? Are you yet living?
Start listening to BBC Radio Shakespeare, a collection of 8 comedies, available to purchase wherever you get your audiobooks.